what happened to the Rohingya is a reflection of the fact that for decades, you've had no accountability in Myanmar. The military's committed these crimes, and they've never been held to account. And if you want to break that cycle of violence, you need to break it all over the country.
Medieval crimes are being committed.
I come with clean hands.
Victims of horrific crimes want justice.
We don't have anything better than this.
This is Asymmetrical Haircuts, your international justice podcast, with Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg. This episode was produced in partnership with justiceinfo.net.
All rise.
Hi, Steph.
Hi, Janet.
So we're recording today the second in our series exploring the international investigative mechanisms. And this time it's the IIMM.
That's the International Investigative Mechanism for Myanmar. So subtly different from the IIIM that we did last month, which is for Syria.
And we should outline for those who don't follow Myanmar justice accountability so intensively that there is quite a lot going on. So I see a Stephopedia coming up. Go on, Steph.
Well, first off, much of what we see in the courts now is connected to the events of late 2016 and 2017, when there was a crackdown on members of the Muslim Rohingya minority community in Myanmar, in Rakhine States, where they were driven out and into refugee camps in neighboring Bangladesh. And that was part of an ongoing war between the Myanmar military and that they said is a reaction to the actions of Rohingya militants.
Perfect Reuters succinctness there. I commend you, Steph. I couldn't do it better myself. But currently, as I think most people do know, they have a military totally in charge there. Civil wars in many provinces would suggest that that's actually even gone away very much over the last decade. There's no more democracy and there's not even much of a prospect of it. There's a lot of context.
On the justice and accountability front, we have an international criminal court investigation, and that's the really interesting one because it's based on jurisdiction out of Bangladesh, where the Rohingya refugees ended up in. So it's deportation as a cross-border crime, which was a kind of novel approach of the ICC. And we have a major genocide case at the UN's top court brought by Gambia against Myanmar. And to top it all off, we have universal jurisdiction cases, for example, a case in Argentina for sexual and gender-based crimes against Rohingya women.
So I would say that this is what we would know in the trade as a triple whammy, the full gamut, you know, all kinds of justice. Against that backdrop of extraordinary efforts at justice, but goodness knows what will be achieved, we have an interview with the head of the IIMM. So welcome, Nick Kumjan.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate the invitation and your interest in our mechanism and justice for Myanmar.
And Nick has been the head of the IIMM since September 2018. We've had this triple whammy. We see all these different mechanisms. Nick, is your job, after having collected these loads of evidence since you started, basically to try to funnel information to all these processes? And how do you juggle the different needs? Because they're all very different processes with different things that they need.
Well, that's part of our job. Our job, we're continuing, of course, to collect evidence. And we are currently sharing with the three partners that you mentioned, the prosecution authorities in Argentina, with the International Criminal Court, and with the International Court of Justice, each being at a different phase of their investigations or proceedings. But we continue to collect evidence. And our mandate is not restricted to what happened to the Rohingya. That's certainly a very important part of it. But our team, we basically divided in two. We have one team working on the Rohingya issue, and the other team works on other issues in the country, which since the February 21 coup has largely been post-coup violence.
And how did these different processes guide your priorities? Have you found that since you started, that as those processes started up, that you really need to gather kind of different kinds of evidence, or that you needed different ways of presenting the evidence?
Well, it's somewhat of an influence. Obviously, we know for almost any criminal case, we need to collect evidence and be able to prove that the crimes happened. And we're, of course, restricted in concentrating on international crimes, the most serious war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. And then you have to look for evidence that would link an individual to show whether an individual is personally criminally responsible for those crimes. What's a bit different is the International Court of Justice proceeding, because there the issue is not an individual responsibility, it's state responsibility. The ICJ hears disputes between countries, and in that case, the Gambia has said it has signed the Genocide Convention along with Myanmar, and Myanmar is not living up to it. So the issue there is whether Myanmar authorities have lived up to their obligations under the convention. And that's caused us to look at some different factors that we wouldn't normally look at in an individual criminal case. I could expand if you want.
I'm sure that Steph will want to pick that up and will want to come back to the ICJ. I just want to understand what it looks like. Do you have a national prosecutor jumping up and down and saying, hey, Mr. IIMM, can you give me X? Or do you already know what they're interested in and say, maybe you'd like this kind of stuff, maybe you'd like to consider this? And since we're talking about prosecutors, I mean, what about fairness of proceedings? What about providing stuff to defense counsel? Do you give them stuff?
Well, we do have conversations with some of those conducting investigations. So the two proceedings in Argentina and at the International Criminal Court are in the investigation stage. There are no defense counsel because there are no defendants. At this stage, those courts are just looking at the evidence to decide whether or not they believe crimes occurred and whether or not they have sufficient evidence to charge any individuals for those crimes. At the International Court of Justice, again, it's not an individual defendant, it's a country, the state of Myanmar. Currently representing the state of Myanmar are the junta authorities. The judges there accepted the junta authorities as the agent replacing the former agent, Aung San Suu Kyi, who, of course, they put in prison and is now in prison. So we originally said we would share with both parties because we think it's very important that the court see us as an objective fact finder. And of course, when evidence is presented in court, both parties have to see it and be able to dispute it. However, we asked each party to give some fundamental guarantees about treating the information confidentially. And since the coup, the junta authorities have not engaged with us at all. So we're currently only sharing evidence with the Gambia and not with Myanmar at the current time.
At the ICC, although there is not yet any defense counsel, I know that there is an obligation for the ICC prosecutor to share any possibly exculpatory evidence in any case. So I assume that they also collect that. Is that something also that you hand over? Do you just kind of hand over whatever you have on a particular case when they ask for it? I wonder, is it more they ask and you deliver, or you say, this is what I have, what is the most interesting to you?
Well, we do have the same obligation as the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court. It's clear in our terms of reference. We have an obligation to collect exonerating evidence also and to make that available to those we share with. So, of course, we would share any exonerating evidence that we collect with the prosecutor at the International Criminal Court.
And I'm wondering about what you've been saying about the ICJ. I understand that you don't give information to the Myanmar side because that's now run by the junta. Is it just to Gambia, or did the judges ever come back to you and say, well, the report that Myanmar's given in isn't sufficient. Gambia says it's not sufficient. Can you help us with some more information? I mean, it's kind of UN to UN. They're a UN court. You're a UN mechanism.
That's correct. They're the highest UN court. But we're not a party to the proceedings. There is a possibility in the rules, as I understand them, of the International Court of Justice for the court to ask for certain expert evidence from a UN agency. That hasn't happened yet. So the evidence that we have been sharing, we've been sharing it with the parties. Originally, it was with both parties, but now only with the Gambia. Of course, if the Gambia uses it, they have to show it to Myanmar. So Myanmar, the junta authorities, will be able to see that evidence. I should say, and I think this is very important in case those that gave us the evidence are listening, we only share when we have the consent of those that provided evidence to us. So we're very conscious of the risk, particularly to witnesses, very, very cautious about sharing that with parties that could include the current authorities and military authorities in Myanmar.
And that opens up another question that we have here on the list. Where does your information come from? Is it civil society organizations, on the ground investigators, open source information? I imagine that the junta is not very warm and open and fuzzy about you investigating Myanmar. So how do you get information?
Well, pretty much all that you mentioned, with the exception of the current military authorities. We do continue to send requests for information to the Myanmar authorities, requests about when we think there's information they might have about crimes that were committed either by military or by the other side. We often request the information. They have not engaged with us. They haven't answered any of those requests, but we'll continue to send them. We think it's important to put those on record. But we also collect information from a wide variety. So, of course, very important are civil society organizations. They're often the first information we have about an incident that points us in the direction of this is something we need to look into. And they often share information with us. They often can help us contact persons who have firsthand information, which is what we ideally seek. We want to, as much as possible, speak directly to those who witnessed events, who have firsthand knowledge about what occurred. Civil society is very helpful to us, but also we rely tremendously on open source. We don't have the opportunity to go to Myanmar because we don't have cooperation from the authorities now. But we look at open source information. So much is on the web nowadays. We look at everything. We collected great amounts of social media evidence, of aerial photographs and analysis of aerial photographs. There's just pretty much almost any type of evidence that you can think of we're collecting. And the total number of items of evidence my information management people tell me is now over 28 million items. You know, I don't think that that number itself tells you that much about what really the value of it is, but it tells you the quantity. So we have a great quantity of evidence, and it's a challenge actually to deal with that quantity of evidence. Most of it is in the Burmese language. So that's very challenging for many reasons to be able to get that into a database that's searchable, and also to have the resources of people that can understand the information and review it.
Want to follow up at some point about how you're doing that analysis, because we're certainly finding that in many of the courts that we're covering. I mean, this massive information, what do you do with it? But first, I want to circle back to something that you mentioned earlier, sort of half of your team working on Rohingya and the other half on non-Rohingya, let's say, international crimes. Is that because there's so much going on with the ongoing civil wars essentially around the borders of Myanmar? I mean, where or what kind of crimes? Can you help give some picture of what that is?
Well, we were created largely in response to a report by the United Nations fact-finding mission for Myanmar. And the fact-finding mission was collecting evidence about what happened when the clearance operations occurred in 2017. They happened to have people on the ground in Bangladesh speaking to earlier refugees when suddenly tens and then hundreds of thousands started streaming across the border. But in the report, they also talk about similar crimes had been committed in conflicts against ethnic groups, particularly in the north of the country, in Shan State and Kachin State. And the fact-finding mission made the point that what happened to the Rohingya really wasn't so different from the modus operandi of how the military had acted in these other conflicts. And they said in some very important ways that what happened to the Rohingya is a reflection of the fact that for decades, you've had no accountability in Myanmar. The military's committed these crimes and they've never been held to account. And if you want to break that cycle of violence, you need to break it all over the country. So the mandate that we were given is to collect evidence of these most serious crimes since 2011, but all over the country. It was never restricted to the Rohingya or to Rakhine State, but it covered everywhere. So when the coup happened, we saw important crimes occurring, and we gave even more resources to our team that was investigating all of these non-Rohingya crimes.
And all of this information you gather also largely with the help of these civil society organizations, and that's a theme that we see in all these special investigative mechanisms. The question is, how do you see their role in your organization and how do you manage those interactions with civil society organizations who often want, they want something to happen, they want their stuff to be used, and they send it all off to some investigative mechanism somewhere else. Then sometimes they are upset at the pace and how slow these things go. We see this kind of played out across different investigative mechanisms. How does it work for you in your particular case?
Well, as I mentioned, we rely a lot upon these organizations, civil society organizations, and they're often the ones that catalyze the beginning of an investigation of a specific incident. They often provide us with key information and many times at great risk to individuals in that organization. We very much appreciate it. So we try to keep up a dialogue. Our teams talk to them. Also, we have an annual exercise, or we're hoping to make it at least annual, which we call the Civil Society Dialogues. I fully admit, I plead guilty to plagiarizing from the IIIM, our sister mechanism for Syria, and their Lausanne platform. Very similar idea. We want to engage directly with civil society and listen to them, hear what they have to say, and explain better what we can do and what we cannot do. I think a very important part of any relationship is having reasonable expectations. So you mentioned the frustration with the slow pace of international justice and the lack of results to date. You know, very unfortunately, that's common. International justice can take many years. Before I came to Myanmar, I was an international prosecutor at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal. I left there in 2019, and that year we got a conviction, we got the trial judgment of the big trial against the former head of the Khmer Rouge Party, Nguyen Chea, and Khieu Samphan, the former head of state. They were convicted of crimes that had happened between 1975 and 79. So 40 years earlier, it took 40 years. Now, obviously, that's too long, but still, it was very important to have that process because that's the history of the country. And everyone over 40 years old in that country is affected by what happened. All those born since have been affected because it's affected their parents, their grandparents, and their nation. So we think it's very important to collect and preserve this evidence. We try to explain the importance of that to the civil societies and listen to them. One of the messages that we have that is often difficult, but it's necessary to convey is our mandate is to share the evidence with judicial authorities that could prosecute these cases, that could bring accountability. So it's not part of our mandate to share with civil society. We're trying to think of what we can do, ways that we can make our information as useful as possible. We don't want it to sit in archives gathering dust. So one of the things we're looking is there any of our information that it would be possible to make public? No one would be endangered. No investigative opportunities would be lost by making it public. And we've identified some analytical products that we hope to make public very soon. But all this is part of the dialogue that we have with civil societies and something I think we have to continually engage with them and continue to work on and rethink how we can best make this relationship fruitful for both they and us.
You mentioned seeing what the IIIM on Syria was doing in terms of their way of engaging with civil society. Another thing that Catherine Macuel was telling us about was they're setting priorities internally for structural investigations on specific areas to examine what they had, these millions of documents, in a specific way. Is that also something that you have resources to do?
Well, that's something we have to do because we have limited resources. So absolutely, there's so many crimes that have happened. We can't concentrate on collecting evidence on all of them, so we have to prioritize. So, for example, one way we prioritize is we do put a priority on collecting evidence of sexual and gender-based violence. The reason for that is because it's, I think, well documented that these crimes are generally underreported and underprosecuted. People don't want to talk about it for very obvious reasons about what occurred in such situations. So we try to put a priority on if there are opportunities to collect that evidence and possibly make a case that relates to that, collecting that evidence. And other times, we look at the number of different factors. We have a whole protocol on how we would prioritize and select cases for investigation, things such as the number of victims. But also, I think one of the things we try to look at is what are likely to be the most fruitful investigations. I think certain kinds of incidents are more difficult to ever be able to prove the individual responsible than others. So those are the kinds of factors that we consider in setting our priorities and deciding on what we're going to assign people to concentrate on.
I'm looking at what you're doing now and what you did before, and I'm wondering, and this is more of a personal question, isn't it incredibly frustrating for you as a former prosecutor to collect all this evidence, waiting for somebody else to decide what and if they are going to do anything with it? Because I can imagine you sitting there in your office thinking, well, if I was the prosecutor, I would have done X, Y, and Z. And here I am. Here's all my evidence. Why aren't you picking it up and running with it?
Yes, it's very frustrating that we don't have a case. And you know, I do miss myself. I don't get the opportunity often to speak to the victims directly, and presenting the facts and the evidence in court is something I do miss very much. But we do think, I think my whole team thinks, that they all share the same frustration, I think. But what we're doing is important. We do believe that it will make a difference someday. We think absolutely victims have this expectation. What I found in all the places I've worked, you know, Bosnia, Darfur, Sierra Leone, Cambodia, East Timor, victims often have a very similar priority desire. They want someone to listen to what happened to them. They want to have that recorded. They want some kind of official record and ideally official acknowledgement this really happened to them, and they want to see someone held to account. We think it's very important for us to be collecting this evidence about these horrible things that have happened to the people of Myanmar. And we just got to keep plugging away in hope that justice will eventually win out and people will be held to account for what they've done.
I'm still harking on you and the IIIM, I'm sorry, because I'm wondering also from what you were talking about, the numbers of documents. You've both got huge amounts of data. Are you essentially sharing the same data systems? And I'm wondering, since you also mentioned this millions of stuff, we've been trying to start to find out how artificial intelligence might start to be used for some kind of a analysis of documents. Are you also going down that road?
So our systems, of course, are separate. And that's very important for security, for one reason. The more separate it is for security, the better. But we learn from each other, and I think our systems are somewhat similar. Our teams, our information management teams, meet regularly and pair notes. You know, some of the technologies that we're using are new for the UN, and any new technology has to be approved on a central basis. So we tag team New York sometimes, ourselves and IIIM Syria, and also sometimes UNICART when they were building their systems. So we try to learn lessons from each other, but our systems are actually separate. So, of course, there's no leaks from one to the other. And we want to keep the access to our systems as restricted as possible because of the need to maintain security.
And on AI?
AI, absolutely. We're using it. I'm not an expert, but all of my ISMS team I know is very interested in AI. When I talk about things like how do we search a database that large and how do we do it when it's in Myanmar language, one of the things that we're looking at are programs that would learn how to better translate, better than what's out there commercially now, material from Myanmar languages to English. So that would be AI. There's a lot of ways that AI is affecting how we do things more and more, and it's absolutely necessary that we keep up. So that's what we have our experts doing.
I have a question that occurred to me while we're talking about all these mountains of evidence and AI. In the beginning of the crackdown on the Rohingya, there was a lot of emphasis on the role also played by Facebook and social media in gearing up resentment against the Rohingya. Is that also one of the reasons why you have such mountains of evidence? Is there a lot of digital evidence because this was one of the first time really that we saw social media being used so widely in such a campaign?
Yes, we have many millions of items of social media evidence. We've gotten millions from Facebook. They've voluntarily given us material that we requested from them about that. And we've done things like looking at social media posts that occurred at the time of the clearance operations. This is one of the reports that we prepared for all three of our sharing partners, but particularly for the International Court of Justice. I think it's relevant. We looked at a period of 6 months and what 43 accounts that Facebook had taken down had posted. And we found about, I believe, 10,000 instances where they had posted what we considered hate speech. We then looked at various indicia from these accounts, from the material that Facebook had given us, and we were able to determine that all of these accounts were linked to the Myanmar military, and they were working in a coordinated fashion. Often, the same post would appear multiple times on different pages in this network. And so the conclusion of that report, which I think makes it so relevant to the issues at the International Court of Justice, is that at the very time of the clearance operations, when villages were being burned, when people were being killed and raped, the Myanmar military was promoting hate speech against this group that was being victimized. So is that consistent with the obligation to prevent and punish genocide? That'll be something the judges of the International Court of Justice will decide.
You mentioned in your mandate that you're basically just looking at international crimes. Just, I mean, they're huge, these international crimes, but they are limited. And one of the international crimes that people who work on Myanmar mentioned to me was the crime of apartheid. And they said, look, Myanmar acceded to the Convention Against Apartheid back in the 1980s. And if you look at what's going on after all, many of the Rohingya left from Rakhine State, that could potentially be interpreted as a situation of apartheid going on there. Is that one of the crimes, one of the focuses that you either have had, may have, are thinking about?
The apartheid description of the crime in the ICC statute and the description in the convention are quite different, but they come down to really persecution of various fundamental rights, or killing members of the group because of a racial bias for racial reasons. So absolutely that could be something that's relevant, particularly on the Rohingya in our situation. We don't concentrate so much on deciding how individual crimes a prosecutor is going to charge in an X jurisdiction, because the prosecutors in that jurisdiction will know so much better what the elements are in their particular jurisdiction. And in many cases, we don't know where we're going to end up, what courts will eventually take these cases. We know only the ones that we currently have. Certainly, that's a possibility that people will look at apartheid. In fact, one of the team members that we have before coming to our mechanism had written an academic article upon the statelessness of the Rohingya and the possibility of criminalizing that, including through the use of the apartheid crime.
I don't want to talk you into any kind of a funk, but is there any process, do you think, of a kind of broad tribunal or some kind of accountability process beyond the things that we mentioned? There is lots of other conflicts going on. There's also lots of other mechanisms. And at the moment, the oxygen is kind of being sucked out of all the accountability conversations by Israel, Hamas, and Ukraine. Meanwhile, in Myanmar, crimes are getting worse, it seems, under the junta, and we've seen no criminal processes yet for the crimes committed since the coup. What do you think the prospects are to get this in front of a judge?
Yeah, that is a little bit above my pay grade, but absolutely that's something we think about and is frustrating. A referral to the International Criminal Court by the Security Council is unlikely, given the current makeup of the Security Council and the current politics. So that doesn't seem something that's about to happen. The NUG has itself self-referred the case back through before the coup, all the crimes in Myanmar to the International Criminal Court, and that is still pending. The court hasn't made a formal decision on that yet. All I could say is that things can change. The political situation can change. Who's in charge of the country of Myanmar can change. If that happens, and if there is a court set up specifically to handle all these crimes, I think it's very important that they have evidence that's been preserved about what happened. So we hope to contribute to that. We're collecting the information, and we hope that there will be a court one day, whether it's an international court or maybe one day domestic courts in Myanmar. If Myanmar makes that transition to really wanting to see accountability and achieving accountability, and that can happen. Countries' governments can change over time. We want the evidence to be there for them.
You use the acronym, the NUG. I think that's the National Unity Government, the people who say that they're still in charge, even though the junta have actually taken over. I think they still have the seat from Myanmar at the UN. Is that correct?
That's correct. For the New York representative.
And I'm just wondering, beyond court cases, you said that you're looking at how to release information that by releasing information wouldn't actually upset any future court case. But I'm wondering whether you see potentially your material being used in some kind of other kind of process, like a truth-telling process in some form.
Yeah, that's absolutely possible. And in fact, our terms of reference say that we're to share with judicial authorities for the purposes of criminal prosecutions of international crimes. But there's also a provision that says, consistent with that purpose, we can consider other uses on a case-by-case basis. So actually, even sharing with the ICJ doesn't fall into that criminal prosecution category. But we said it's so closely connected, you know, it's about crimes that happened in Myanmar. It's such an important case for victims. It can help victims achieve some measure of justice that we would be sharing evidence. We think it's very important that the judges at the ICJ have the very best evidence before they make that important decision. We're always thinking of ways that our evidence could possibly be used constructively, but also in a way that we don't compromise investigations, and we certainly don't want to do anything that would compromise the privacy or security of those that gave us the information.
One of the closest other mechanisms, the UNITAD, we're looking at ISIS crimes in Iraq, is now closing down. Are you worried about also interest in what's going on in Myanmar waning and your mechanism closing down? And what then will happen to the archives and the material? Do you already have a plan?
Well, I don't think there's any current risk of our mechanism closing down. I think there is generally in the international community a recognition that what's happening in Myanmar is horrible. I think most would say that the international community needs to do more. You know, what else can they do? They're not doing enough, but certainly at least collect the evidence of these very worst crimes that are happening in the country. So I don't feel myself that kind of pressure. We're under financial pressure like all of the UN this year. But eventually someday, I think we will close. And that was always the intent. We're not a permanent institution. But I do think a lot of thinking has to go into what happens to our evidence when we do close. And I think some of that thinking will have to happen right now because of UNITAD closing. So it'll be a very similar situation with UNITAD. They have evidence that they've collected, as I understand it, including evidence from victims. There's issues always about how you can use that evidence, whether you have the consent of the individuals for whatever process. So I don't think it makes sense to just send all this information to an archive that normally is just sitting in a closed room without any expertise and the kind of computer systems, et cetera, to make this information accessible to those that may need it someday for accountability, for cases, or for other purposes. And also that can realistically and effectively deal with issues like, do we have consent from those that provided the information to share this? Would sharing this information maybe, for example, violate the privacy of a rape victim who isn't the one who gave us the information, but is named? So those are the kind of very important decisions that have to be made. And I think it requires an expertise. And I think some kind of permanent body that would maybe be the residual holder of the information from all of the different tribunals and mechanisms as they slowly finish their work and transition to that phase.
Well, you took the question right out from under us. This is exactly what we wanted to finish off with. But just before I do put it to you again, I want to give a shout out to what will be the next one in the series, published a month after you. We're going to be talking to the head of UNITAD about what it's like to deal with the mechanism that's closing. And then we're also going to discuss this idea for some kind of a super, super permanent mechanism.
Super duper.
see how realistic that is. Yeah, I mean, really, that is my question. Yeah, you might think it's a nice idea, but is it realistic?
Well, it depends on what the mechanism, how it exactly is designed. And I know I've spoken to those that have put forward various iterations of this idea. You know, I do think a mechanism that would just have the authority to investigate any serious crimes around the world may not be realistic. I think states are not likely to support something that's so independent as far as its mandate is concerned. But I do think there's a recognition that there's two important phases where it doesn't make sense to be doing this from the beginning all over again each time. And that's the startup phase and the closing down phase. So the startup phase, I think we talked about our information systems. They're very similar, these different mechanisms. Probably there are some savings that could be had by having some kind of standing body that would be prepared to provide that kind of information, somehow siphoned off and separated from other information for an organization, rather than just starting by hiring one information technology officer and building it from scratch. And similarly, on the issues of how you deal with information that's stored that may be needed for future criminal processes and dealing again with consent and privacy issues, I think it makes sense that there be a residual mechanism that would handle all of these rather than create individual bodies each time this happens.
Well, thank you very much for explaining all of this to us. We always end the podcast with what we call asymmetrical haircuts questions. And the first one is really a softball one, but this is your opportunity to raise anything that we didn't ask. So is there anything that you want to highlight or that we should have asked, but we didn't?
I can't think of that, but I did think of something, maybe an answer I didn't quite get to. You asked me about things we would be able to make public. So one of the types of reports that we think we could make public and we're planning to is we did a report about the public information that was available to Myanmar authorities about sexual violence against the Rohingya during the 2016-2017 clearance operations. These were very serious allegations that were made by international bodies, by civil society organizations, by UN bodies, by the International Criminal Court Pretrial Chamber talked about sexual violence. And then we looked at what did the Myanmar authorities do in response and looked at some of the details of the way that they investigated or opened inquiries about these and what were the results. And basically found that, as far as we know, no one was ever punished or demoted for sexual violence against the Rohingya. And these very serious allegations never have been, from what we can see, properly investigated by the authorities, which again goes to the state's obligations to prevent and punish genocide, because there's a lot of jurisprudence about sexual violence, if committed with the intent of genocide, could be an act of genocide. Because we're not dealing with what witnesses told us, with what victims told us, which obviously would be very problematic. We would never want to make public individual names and testimonies. It's what was publicly known to the authorities at the time. So they wouldn't know what maybe an individual victim experienced because they didn't speak to them, but they certainly would have been aware of these public announcements by different authorities. That we think we can make public, and we're planning to.
And our second question that we like to ask is, do you have a favorite court case? And we've obviously worked quite widely in this field. I wonder whether you might choose one of your own cases, but is there something you tend to refer to when you're trying to give an example, or, you know, a favorite one from when you were studying?
Of course, obviously the trials that I was part of, the main ones are the Stockage case at ICTY, the Charles Taylor trial in Sierra Leone, and the trial at the Khmer Rouge Tribunal of the top leaders of the Khmer Rouge. All of them, they are very important to me personally. I feel very privileged to have been part of those, met some incredible people. The victims that testified, well, I'll never forget them. I think there are some very interesting lessons to be learned from those. And I think certainly that's affected me and continues to affect how I approach the job I currently have. I've thought about the strategies that were used, about the ways that we prove the responsibility of the individuals, because always that's the real challenge on these leadership cases. It's not so difficult to prove that the crimes happened. But why is a group of women being raped in a village that the accused person has never been to, never knew the victims, never met them, probably never met or spoke to the direct perpetrators? Why is he responsible? That's the challenge of these leadership cases in international criminal law. And it can be done. We've done it. I think I've been lucky. I've been successful in all of these trials. And I hope to do the same for the people of Myanmar so that there can be justice, so they can see people held to account for the horrible crimes that have been committed against them.
Completely randomly, before I got on this podcast, I was actually reading the Stuckage judgment because somebody asked me a question about genocide. And in Bosnia, the only incident of genocide is Srebrenica, but there were also attempts to get the camps in Prijedor convicted for genocide. And Stuckage is one of the cases for that, just to show that these cases still are very important and people are still reading them, because I have the Stuckage judgment open on this computer actually at the moment, because a Ukrainian journalist was asking me about it. It all links together, those kind of cases.
In relation to that, you know, one of the arguments that we made in Stuckage of genocidal intent is that he had made the statement that the Bosnian Muslims were an artificial nation. So that could be very similar to some of the rhetoric about Ukraine.
I am definitely going to send a WhatsApp message to my Ukrainian colleague and tell her that, so that she can pick that particular aspect out. The final question is a bit more mundane, but we always ask, what are you reading, watching, listening to that you would recommend to our audience? And it can be work-related, and for a lot of our interviewees, it is work-related, but it could also be what you do to get away from all the war crimes that you deal with at work.
I mean, one book I've read recently that I found very interesting was Gary Bass's book about the Tokyo trials, and found that never really knew all those details about the trials like he put. And I still find it a bit of a mystery why that judgment is seen as such a failure while Nuremberg is considered such a success. But I guess I understand a little bit more after reading that book. And then in movies, while I usually watching like 6 Netflix movies at a time for some reason, I've been rewatching the John Travolta, the classic that talks about the metric system for Le Royale, why you don't have a quarter pounder for McDonald's.
Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, Pulp Fiction. Yeah. So that is, I find relaxing to watch a little Pulp Fiction, which I hadn't seen in a decade or so.
This was Asymmetrical Haircuts, your international justice podcast, created and presented by Janet Anderson and Stephanie van den Berg. This episode was produced in partnership with justiceinfo.net, an independent site covering justice effort for mass violence. Music is by audionautics.com, and you can find show notes and everything about the podcast on asymmetricalhaircuts.com. This show is available on every major podcast service, so please subscribe, give us a rating, and spread the word.
Hi, it's us again.
Just to say that if you enjoyed the interview and you want to support our work, head on over to patreon.com and buy us a coffee there.
That way, you also get to hear the extra War Criminals Book Club podcast that we do every month.
And twice a year, we show you a little bit of what goes on behind the scenes. You can meet the team and ask what subjects you'd like us to cover.
And there's a monthly newsletter.
All for just the price of a cup of coffee and a bit of cake every month.
And you get the deep appreciation from our team for your support.
Thank you very much.
Always bloody well getting the last word.
Always.